Let's take our Bibles this evening and turn to Psalm 18. We need to finish that study that we started this morning, looking at the second half of this great psalm. This morning we looked at the first 19 verses and we saw David's devoted summary, a deadly situation, his dramatic Savior, the living God, and of course a decisive salvation. This evening we need to cover the rest of the psalm, in which David discusses God's blessing on the earthly years of his, David's, public life. Verses 20 through 50 are basically an extended thank you. An extended thank you from David to God for the strength, for the task to be the king of Israel. And in these verses, David is going to develop the interconnection between human responsibility and divine grace. We're familiar with Philippians 2, work out your salvation because it is God who is at work in you. It's that kind of relationship that David's going to develop here. The interplay between David's responsibility to be good, to live right, and, of course, God's grace that made it all possible. He's going to develop both of those. Let's pick up our reading in verse 16, and we'll read through the end of the psalm. God sent from on high, and he took me, and he drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my stay. They brought me forth also into a broad place. He brought me forth into a broad place, and he rescued me because he delighted in me. The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his ordinances were before me, and I did not put away his statutes from me. I was also blameless with him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his eyes. With the kind, you show yourself kind. With the blameless, you show yourself blameless. And with the pure, you show yourself pure. With the crooked, you show yourself astute. For you save an afflicted people, but haughty eyes, you abase. For you light my lamp, the Lord of my God, he illumines my darkness. For by you I can run upon a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is blameless, the word of the Lord is tried. He is a shield to all those who take refuge in him. For who is God but the Lord? Who is a rock except our God? The God who girds me with strength and who makes my way blameless. He makes my feet like hinds' feet and sets me upon my high places. He trains my hands for battle so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You've also given me the shield of your salvation. Your right hand upholds me. Your gentleness makes me great. You enlarge my steps under me and my feet have not slipped. I pursued my enemies and overtook them. I did not turn back until they were consumed. I shattered them so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. For you have girded me with the strength for battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. You have also made my enemies turn their backs to me, and I destroyed those who hated me. They cried for help, but there was none to save. Even to the Lord, but he did not answer them. Then I beat them fine as the dust before the wind, and I emptied them out as the mire of the streets. You have delivered me from the contentions of the people. You have placed me as the head of the nations. A people whom I have not known serve me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. Foreigners submit to me. Foreigners fade away and come trembling out of their fortresses. The Lord lives. And blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation. The God who executes vengeance for me and subdues peoples under me. He delivers me from my enemies. Surely you lift me above those who rise up against me. You rescue me from violent men. Therefore I will give thanks to you. I will give thanks to you among the nations, O Lord, and I will sing praises to your name. He gives great deliverance to his king and shows loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. Now, it's very clear as you read it that this psalm thrusts us into a very specific and, frankly, somewhat unfamiliar context. And that is the context of an ancient Near Eastern warrior king. While the military terminology is accessible to us, what is perhaps very foreign to us is David's celebration of his military success, the defeat and the subjugation of enemies, the ability to lead a charge into an enemy battle line, to be the first one over the wall of a besieged city. I would suspect that a request for the ability to bend a bow of bronze probably didn't enter into any of your prayers this week. Anyone? Anyone pray that? Probably not. Nor did a request for the strength to pursue your enemies and to shatter them, to pulverize them like dust. And we're a peace-loving society, and well, that's a good thing. And as a result, you know, we love the picture of God's enthusiastic delivery in the opening half of Psalm 18 as we studied it this morning. We love that, God charging out of the heavens to rescue his people. But we might feel a little bit bewildered and, depending on your makeup, even a little bit put off when we read David's overtly military prayers and celebrations in the second half of this psalm. It is perhaps hard for us to understand. Hard for us to understand and to value what David clearly values here. And so my job tonight is to give you an introduction that will help you understand this specific slice of God's gracious empowerment. God's help to David in David's specific role in Israel at a very specific time in Israel's history. To do that, we're going to have a bit of an extended introduction. Uncle Joel in history, watch out, right? You know this. Thankfully, the second half of the psalm is, in fact, though quite simple. David really only says two things. You may not have seen it reading through. It seems to say a lot, but in truth, he says only two things in verses 20 through 50. And the fact that he kept it so simple allows us the time then to develop the historical and the personal background that is essential, absolutely essential, to understanding why David spoke of God's grace gift of empowerment to be Israel's warrior king. And so, this is not the title of the sermon, but even the introduction, it's so long it needs its own title. Even the introduction tonight is going to need a title. The introduction to this sermon is going to be called The Tale of Two Kings. The Tale of Two Kings. And to see that as the absolutely essential setup to this psalm, I want you to turn to 1 Samuel. We're going to spend a lot of time in 1 and 2 Samuel tonight. You can start in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel. And then understanding the background, Psalm 18 will make perfect sense. In a sense, all we'll have to do is read it, and all the pieces will fall right into place. But if you don't do the background, it just doesn't work. So let's start in 1 Samuel. The prologue to the book of 1 Samuel is really the book of Judges. And as you know, the book of Judges is basically a book of failure. It's a book of failure. The parents fail to instruct their children. The nation fails to worship Yahweh. The leaders whom God raises up fail to deliver Israel in any lasting and enduring way. And one of the reasons for that is the judges, men like Ehud, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, and many others. One of the reasons is they were all basically local deliverers. Not one of them led the nation as a whole. They worked in their own little areas. There was also no continuity in their leadership. And sometimes they were just, you know, kind of sinful, self-focused men, like Samson, for example. The judge model of leadership was clearly never going to be a lasting solution. It was not going to be a lasting solution to Israel's spiritual waywardness. Nor was it a solution to an equally significant problem, at least in the daily human life area, and that was the plaguing problem of their constant domination by international enemies. Now, Samuel, who, of course, you meet at the beginning of the book of Samuel, he is the last judge of the nation of Israel. And Samuel does have a higher level of success than many of those who preceded him. His leadership was a bit more national, and on the personal level, he was a genuinely godly man. And under his leadership, there was some moral reform, some religious reform in Israel. So some good things happened under Samuel's leadership. And indeed, there was some success against the Philistines, the specific international enemy who was most actively oppressing Israel at that point in their history. Let's pick it up in our little history review in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel, verse 13. Samuel plays many roles, and one of them was bringing the nation together to allow them to resist this constant oppression by military oppressors by the nation of the Philistines. So, verse 13, so the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. There is success with Samuel that the other judges did not have, and especially with the Philistines. However, as Samuel nears the end of his life, the weakness of the judges' model, ungodly leaders, lack of continuity, becomes very obvious in his sons. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together. They came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons," they're named earlier in verse 2, "your sons do not walk in your ways." The judges' system is just not working. And here's their solution. Now appoint a king. Appoint a king for us to judge us, to lead us like the nations. Now, you remember Samuel tried to talk them out of their desire for a king, but God intervenes and assures Samuel that this request is indeed part of his overall plan. It's part of his plan for the nation of Israel, even if this specific request arose out of a bit of a rebellious spirit. It is God's plan that they, in due time, have a king. They have a human king. Yahweh is their divine king, but they're to have a human king. And God says, "Samuel, don't worry, it's part of the plan." Now, notice at the end of chapter 8 what the issue that is especially on the people's mind is. Verse 19. "Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel." He's tried to talk them out of having a king. "And they said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge,'" and here I would translate "lead, that he may lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." We're tired of being a punching bag for the Philistines. Their desire to be like the nations was undoubtedly a bad one. But the desire to have someone to lead them in war was a very normal and very natural one for a people who have for several hundred years been under the oppression and the domination of this nation or that nation or some other nation. You remember the judges had led Israel in their disjointed fashion for about 300 years, from about 1350 or so to around 1150 BC, about 300 years. And as the book of Judges makes clear, for at least the last two-thirds of that period, Israel had been bullied and beaten up by the surrounding nations. I mean, imagine if you here in South Africa, if we had been beaten up and bullied by Mozambique. I know it sounds a little silly, but, you know, or by Zimbabwe or by Angola, right? If we had been beaten up and bullied, oppressed and dominated by a Nazi Germany-like set of oppressors, and that had been going on for the last 200 years. Now you're starting to get the picture. Ammon, Moab, Midian, the Amalekites, the Philistines, especially the Philistines. They had all piled on. They had all piled on. In fact, you remember in the opening chapters of 1 Samuel, the Philistines had even captured the Ark of the Covenant. Yahweh's symbolic earthly throne had been captured, taken to their cities, and of course, God, you know, frees himself. He doesn't need Israel's help to do that. But this is the sort of thing that's going on. Although there had been some limited success in fighting the Philistines under Samuel, the judges' system simply wasn't working. It just wasn't working. Thousands were dying in fruitless, unwinnable battles against the Philistines. Cities are being wiped out, crops hijacked, women, wives, daughters, sons taken as slaves. While desert raiders like the Amalekites terrorized the countryside, came through and stole your kids, your wife, your crops, and headed back out into the desert. While they were doing that, the haughty urban Philistines, with their technological superiority and their military elite culture, they dominated the squabbling, disunited Israelite tribes. It's not a pretty picture. The defense of Israel just absolutely had to be more organized. It had to be more effective. These people are living under the boot of various enemies, now especially the Philistines. Yahweh was their divine king, fully able to protect them, but their lack of faith in him made it impossible for them to follow his invisible leadership. They should have been following, and he would have been glad to protect them, but they just can't, because of their lack of faith, follow an invisible divine warrior king. And so they asked, as had been God's plan all along, according to Deuteronomy 17, they asked for a king. They asked for a human king. They asked for someone they can follow, someone they can see. A visible man whom they could follow, who could reform their worship. They might not have been thinking about that. I think Samuel was. But who could reform their worship and fight their battles. And so a man was chosen. You remember his name was Saul. King Saul was chosen. He was externally impressive, tall and lordly in appearance. He seemed to be the perfect choice. However, as you look at the picture, unfortunately, Saul proved to have all the weaknesses of the judges. His leadership was local, way too focused on Benjamin and Gibeah. He was, in his own way, just as self-focused as Samson had been. Samson's problem was sexual sin. Saul is incredibly self-focused just in other ways. Saul's character is consistently ungodly. He's certainly no improvement on Samuel's sons, however bad they were. Saul is dominated by man-fearing, and he was disobedient to God's direct and specific commands, and he even ended his life in apostasy, you remember? Employing occult techniques to call up the dead in a fit of desperation, rather than repenting and calling on the living God. In fact, you can jot down 1 Chronicles 10, verses 13 and 14. And there the biblical historian gives this brief, sad summary of Saul's life and Saul's death. 1 Chronicles 10 says this, So Saul died for his trespass, which he committed against the Lord because of the word of the Lord, which he did not keep. And also because he asked the counsel of a medium, making inquiry of it, and did not inquire of Yahweh. Therefore, Yahweh, the Lord, killed him. That's what it says. The Lord killed Saul and turned the kingdom of David over to David, the son of Jesse. Now, that might already, even initially, start to bring some things in Psalm 18 into focus. It starts to bring into focus why David said in that psalm, by God's grace, I have kept the ways of the Lord and not wickedly departed from my God. Who do you think David had in mind in contrast as he writes that? And he writes, the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. Who does he have in mind that God has rewarded according to his unrighteousness? You see, you can't understand what David says in Psalm 18 until you understand his self-descriptions there as a stark and powerful contrast to the life and the reign of Saul. So Saul died for his trespass, the chronicler said. Therefore, Yahweh killed him and gave his kingdom to David, the son of Jesse. Now, let's develop that a little bit more. Let's develop that thought a little bit more from 1 and 2 Samuel, because again, we need to deepen our understanding of the history before Psalm 18 will make sense to us. You're pretty familiar with Saul's ignominious track record in 1 Samuel, but let's just walk through it. Saul's first attempt to rescue his people from the tyranny of the Philistines, I mean, this is why they made him king. We want a tall guy, an impressive guy, right, who can beat up the Philistines. Saul's very first attempt fizzles into nothing. Fizzles into nothing because of Saul's rash and impatient act of sacrificing to God as if he were a Levitical priest. Chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 13. You remember the story, Samuel is delayed in coming. Saul, the end of verse 12, says, I forced myself to offer the burnt offering. Verse 13 of chapter 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. Your kingdom shall not endure. In fact, not only will Saul's kingdom not endure, but rather than successfully defeating the Philistine oppressors as he has been appointed to do, here's the biblical summary of Saul's life and reign. Chapter 14, right at the end of that chapter, the very last verse. 1 Samuel 14, verse 52. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. That's not what you want to hear. When you were appointed to be king and your one job was to beat the Philistines, you don't want the summary of your four decades of ruling Israel to be the war was severe. Never stopped, never ended, never won. He had been appointed as king specifically to rescue his people from the slaughter, from the tyranny, from the boot of the Philistines. But over the 40 years of his reign, all of Saul's efforts were at the very best inconclusive. And in fact, we'll find it's much worse than that. The war just kept on going. And one defeat followed another with no meaningful success, with the Philistines taking more and more land and exercising more and more coercive authority over the tribes of Israel. Now, in chapter 15, there's a hopeful success. They finally beat up on the Amalekites, those desert raiders who would sweep in and take all the crops and kidnap your wife and your kids, your daughters and so on, and carry them back into the wilderness. There's a hopeful victory against the Amalekites, but it's soured. It's soured and spoiled by Saul's disobedience. God gave direct orders. Saul didn't keep them. And you remember Samuel's rebuke to King Saul is absolutely scathing. Chapter 15, verse 26. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. Now, the interesting thing is Saul would continue to be the king of Israel for many years after this. But God has rejected him from being king. It's not a good plan to be king when God has rejected you from being king. How do you think that's going to go? Not very well, is it? And notice something else in this chapter. Saul's resulting plea to Samuel provides a window, a little keyhole glimpse into Saul's heart. Saul's man-fearing, self-focused character. Look at verse 30. Chapter 15, verse 30. It just comes pouring out of this verse. Saul, in a fit of false repentance, he says, I've sinned. That sounds good. But please honor me now. That doesn't sound like a guy who's repentant, does it? I've sinned, but honor me, Samuel, before the elders of my people and before Israel. Go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. That's a glimpse into Saul's heart. Please honor me. And that just about sums up all of Saul's concerns, all of Saul's desire, all of Saul's thought life, everything that's going on in the chapters that follow. Please honor me. That's all he thinks. That's who he is. Now, up to this point, our historical background has been the tale of one king, right? King Saul. However, now it is going to become the tale of two kings, as I promised. Because in 1 Samuel 16, Samuel anointed David to be the next king of Israel. Chapter 16, verse 13. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and he anointed him, David, in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. Samuel arose, went to his home, that's in Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. That is the decisive moment. That is the decisive moment in the tale of these two kings. If you're familiar with 1 Samuel, you can predict, you know what's going to happen, you can connect the dots. If you're not familiar with 1 Samuel, you should be able to predict by guessing what it's going to look like. God took his spirit of empowerment away from Saul. And although David was not yet king, it would not be for many, many years, God gave his enabling spirit to David. All the power to be king was transferred from Saul to David, even though David was not yet king. That explains most of the rest of 1 Samuel. Saul is appointed to deal with the Philistine threat. That's job one. But when God takes away the spirit of empowerment, how does it go? Well, in chapter 17, Saul cowers and waffles in the face of Goliath's taunting insults. In contrast, David trusts and triumphs by the power of the Spirit of God, and a great victory is won. Jump to the end of chapter 17, verse 50 and 51. 1 Samuel 17, verse 50, thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, which is not usually the way you bring down a professional warrior. He struck the Philistine in the forehead, said verse 49. He struck the Philistine and killed him, it says in verse 50. There was no sword in David's hands. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of the sheath and killed him, cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. That had never happened under Saul's leadership. Never. Now, in the chapters that follow, Saul shows his character to be irreversibly self-focused. Please honor me is his motto. It's the bumper sticker on his chariot, and it just never changes. You remember what happens in chapter 18. Saul panics. He gets insanely jealous over the praise that David received for the victory over Goliath. Saul has killed his thousands, David his 10,000s. And so whenever David is around, Saul is dominated by unjust suspicion, fear, bitterness, anger, scheming, violent, and murderous rages. Rather than embrace David as God-empowered help from God, I mean, this guy, David, could have been Saul's greatest help. Rather than embrace David's help to defeat the Philistines, Saul continually tries to devise schemes to have David killed by the Philistines. The job that Saul was hired to do, David, even before he's king, took over and did with resounding success. Look at chapter 19, verse 8. 1 Samuel 19, verse 8. When there was war again, David went out and he fought with the Philistines and defeated them with a great slaughter so that they fled before him. David slaughtered Israel's Philistine oppressors. The only people that Saul slaughters in these chapters is 85 priests of Nob and their innocent families when they helped David. David slaughters Philistines, Saul slaughters Israelites. It's the tale of two kings. In chapter 23, David fights the Philistines, Saul fights David. Chapter 23, verse 5, starts with David. So David went with his men to Keilah and fought the Philistines. And he led away their livestock, and he struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. And that's what God's warrior king was supposed to do. Here's what Saul did. Verse 8. Same chapter, verse 8. So Saul summoned all the people for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David fights the Philistines. Saul fights David. All this and David's persistent refusal to take any form of revenge against Saul, in spite of all Saul's unjust treatment of him, all of that eventually leads Saul to make an admission in chapter 24. Chapter 24, verse 17. It's after one of those times that David could have killed Saul and didn't. Saul said to him in verse 17, "You are more righteous than I, David. For you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you." In chapter 26, a similar situation happens. David and some of his men, you remember, snuck into Saul's camp in the middle of the night and nicked Saul's spear and water bottle while everyone's asleep. And having slipped away to safety across a deep ravine so they couldn't get caught easily, David then has this following shouting match conversation with Saul and some of his men, shouting back across the valley in the dark in the night. Chapter 26, verse 21. And Saul says, he knows it's David now, he says, "I've sinned." He says that a lot. It doesn't seem to make any difference, does it? "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you." Yeah, right. "I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool," says Saul, "and I have committed a serious error." And David replied, "Behold, the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness." Sound familiar? "The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed." Saul admits his foolishness, his sinfulness. David entrusts himself to the Lord who judges righteously. Humbly certain that God will reward Saul according to Saul's sin and David according to his righteousness. I mean, it should sound familiar, because that is exactly the thought, exactly the theme that David develops in verses 20 through 27 of Psalm 18. Exactly that. But the story continues, as you know. In 1 Samuel 28, Saul, the king who is appointed to do nothing else, I mean, at least job one is this, to defeat the Philistines, he fails again, swamped by cold sea waves of fear. Chapter 28, verse 5. When Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When the Spirit of God is not empowering you to be king, that's what it looks like. And when God refused to answer him because of Saul's continual waywardness, continual rebellion, continual rejection of God, and the killing of the priests of Nob and all that, what Saul did is he sought counsel, not God's counsel, but he sought the counsel of the dead in the place of the living God. Quite unexpectedly, God allowed Samuel to return from the dead, and he returned for a few moments to pronounce this final summary of Saul's reign. Chapter 28, verse 19. Here's the final word. Here's the final summary. Saul's reign, verse 19. Samuel, called back from the dead, says, "Moreover, Yahweh will also give over Israel, along with you, Saul, into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me." Meaning they'll be dead. I don't think Saul was a believer, but he'll be dead. "Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines." You see, when you've been appointed to be the king primarily to defeat the Philistines, that's bad news. Instead of winning and defeating them as he should, instead of putting the Philistines under his boots, Saul would be defeated by them. Indeed, he and his sons would all be dead in a matter of hours. Again, the chronicler in 1 Chronicles 10, verse 7, he adds this footnote about that day and the results of it, that battle and its results. He says this, "When all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in their cities." Defeat and occupation. It was total, cataclysmic, absolute failure for Israel's first warrior king, for their first human warrior king. It was a failure in character. It was a failure in faith. It was a failure in obedience. It was a failure in task. Now, in the meantime, Israel's second king, though he is not yet king at all, he is proving his character, his faith, his obedience, and his skill to lead and defeat enemies. Because in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel, you remember the Amalekites taking advantage of the fact that the Philistines were attacking Israel. The Amalekites raided David's temporary home. It was a city called Ziklag. And he took David's wives captive and on many of the other populace of that city as well. Now, looking for a convenient scapegoat, as people always will when things go wrong, the people of Ziklag blame David. One book on leadership said, you know, they'll build a statue to you out of the stones they threw at you during life. You know, don't worry about it, leaders. Just lead. Just do the right thing. So here they're throwing the stones at David that they will later build, you know, a monument to him from. They're blaming David, totally unjustly, they're blaming David for the barbaric atrocities that the Amalekites have committed as they swept in, raided the city, killed, burnt, taken captives. It's all David's fault somehow, he wasn't even there. In response to that unjust accusation, David did something that Saul never ever did. Chapter 30 of 1 Samuel, verse 6. "Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him." I mean, that's how bad it is. "For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters." They've been kidnapped. "But David strengthened himself in Yahweh, his God." Saul had never done that. Not in 40 years. Not ever. Never. David was a man of entirely different character than Saul was. Saul sought the counsel of the dead, failed to rescue his people, committed suicide, and his family died with him. In contrast, in these chapters, you find that David sought the counsel of God by the means of the priest's prophetic office and is given gracious success, rescues his family and everyone else too. Verses 7 and 8. David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Please bring me the ephod." And so Abiathar brought the ephod to David, the Urim and Thummim, the way of that God would work through and tell them his will. David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?" God said to him, "Pursue." Very important. David inquired of Yahweh. Just a chapter or two before, who did Saul inquire of? A medium, a spiritist. He's going to the demons and the dead on behalf of the living. David, in contrast, inquires of the Lord. And what is God's answer? God's answer is, "Pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all." Saul's family died. David's family is rescued. And not just his family, but everyone else too. And so hopefully you're starting to grasp the plot line of the story, this tale of two kings. Saul lived wrongly, and God's gracious empowerment to be Israel's warrior king was removed from him. He was given multiple opportunities, but when he persisted in his rebellion, God removed his hand of blessing with catastrophic results. David lived rightly. And God's grace of empowerment to be Israel's warrior king was multiplied to David. Now, the story continues on into 2 Samuel. Look at 2 Samuel 5. After a seven-year civil war, which is detailed in chapters 3 and 4 of 2 Samuel, a civil war that explains so many of David's comments about enemies in the Psalms, enemies within Israel who are after him both in the civil war and after. After all of that, after 7 years, David finally ascended to the throne of all Israel. Now, the task before him has not changed. It has not changed one whit from the day that Saul had been appointed as king decades earlier. The task has not changed. While the Israelites were fighting each other, no one was evicting the Philistines from Israel. No one. And so the question is, will David succeed? Will David succeed in defeating this tyranny, this oppression, where Saul has failed? And indeed he will. Indeed he will. And the author of 2 Samuel lets the cat out of the bag immediately. And in verse 5 of chapter 5, we're told that David reigns over all Israel, first over Judah for 7 years, and then 7.5 years, and then over the whole nation from Jerusalem for 33 years. And in verse 10, as he's still giving a summary about everything that's going on, verse 10, David became greater and greater, for Yahweh God, the God of hosts, was with him. You know what Yahweh of hosts means? It means Yahweh of armies. And when Yahweh of armies is with you, you're going to win. When you're the human warrior king and Yahweh of armies is with you, you're going to win. And in fact, that's exactly what happens next. Jump down to verse 17. When the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek out David. What would have Saul done? He would have cowered in fear. When David heard it, he went down to the stronghold. Now, the Philistines came, they spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. Then David inquired, not of a spiritist and demons and the dead, he inquired of the Lord. He inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hands. You see, Saul failed in faith, he failed in obedience, he failed in task. David succeeds in all three. Faith in God, obedience to God, and he will succeed in the task as well. In fact, where Saul's reign ended with suicide, the death of his sons, and a catastrophic civil war, David's reign will never end. David's reign will never end because God promised him an eternal line in the Davidic covenant of chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7, eventually fulfilled not in an eternal progression of kings, but an eternal succession of kings, but in one king who will reign eternally, our Lord Jesus Christ. But here are the promises, chapter 7, verse 12. When your days are complete and you lie down, David, with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you. How different than Saul, whose sons are all dead with him there on the hillside. He has committed suicide, they have been slaughtered. God says to David, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 15, my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul. What happened with Saul, I'm not going to do that with Solomon, your son. It's not going to happen. Saul, whom I removed from before you, your house and your kingdom, David, shall endure before me forever. Your throne will be established forever. It's the tale of two kings. That's what 1 and 2 Samuel is about. And just to make sure that you don't miss the point, here's how the biblical historian starts chapter 8. You got the Davidic covenant, and then chapter 8 opens with these words. Chapter 8, verse 1. Now after this, it came about that David defeated the Philistines. For hundreds of years, these people have been oppressed militarily, have been dominated, have been occupied, have been run roughshod over. David, as the God-empowered king, comes to the throne. And God gives him an eternal line and says, oh, by the way, go take care of the Philistines. After this, it came about that David defeated the Philistines. He subdued them. David took control of the chief city from the hands of the Philistines. They had occupied Israel. David now occupies their cities. And for completion's sake, because it's important in Psalm 18 as well, we're getting there. Don't worry, we're almost back home. For completion's sake, I should mention 2 Samuel 9 as well. You remember, Saul's failures were not limited to faith and obedience and task. They also included a dramatic failure of character. Jealousy, bitterness, and revenge typified Saul. David was a profoundly different man. In 2 Samuel 9, David did what Saul did. He sought out. He sought out Mephibosheth, the crippled grandson of Saul. But he didn't seek out Mephibosheth to kill him, as Saul had been seeking out David. David, you remember, even had to take his parents to Moab because he was afraid that Saul would kill them as a form of revenge. Saul sought out Mephibosheth, the crippled grandson of Saul, not to kill him as would have been normal in ancient Near Eastern throne scrambles. You always killed everyone in the other family so that they couldn't replace you. David sought out Mephibosheth not to take revenge, but to give grace, to give kindness, to adopt him into his family, say, come, eat at my table for the rest of your life. Saul spent a decade chasing David around the wilderness, trying to murder him. David seeks out his grandson and says, let me give you grace. So that's the tale of two kings. Now turn back to Psalm 18. Turn back to Psalm 18. That is the utterly, absolutely essential background for the second half of this great psalm. In fact, virtually all we need to do now is read the verses. It's like doing a 2,000-piece puzzle. When you start, it's just this random mass of pieces. But when there's only five left, it's like click, 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 done, right? They snap easily into place. Now we got the puzzle picture there, and all we need to do is snap in the last few pieces. Verse 16 of Psalm 18, God sent from on high, he took me, he drew me out of many waters. We've been reading about those waters, haven't we? He delivered me from my strong enemy, from Saul, from the civil war, from the Philistines, from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my stay. He brought me forth into the broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. As I said this morning, I believe that David wrote this psalm right about that time period where we ended our survey of 1 and 2 Samuel, because you know what comes next in 2 Samuel. David's failures. I believe David wrote this psalm right in that time period where we stopped. Saul and the civil war clearly in the rearview mirror. David's military successes over the Philistines and over all of his other international enemies have been resoundingly won. Bathsheba is not even yet a cloud on a clear sunlit horizon. And as David surveys his life up to that point, and especially as he contrasts his life with the spoiled and tarnished life and reign of King Saul, David had two thoughts. I told you there are only two things, right? Two thoughts about God's deliverance and blessing. He's really only got two things to say in verses 20 through 50. Those two thoughts are this: the place of living right in God's plan for blessing, the place for living right, and the primacy of grace in God's plan for blessing. Those are his two thoughts. The whole rest of the psalm fits under those two headings. The place of right living, the place of living right in God's plan for blessing his people, and the primacy of grace in God's plan for blessing his people. In verses 20 through 27, David starts with the place of living right in God's plan of blessing. Verse 20, the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. the very words he said to Saul back in 1 Samuel 26. The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. For I have kept all the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his ordinances were before me, and I did not put away his statutes from me. I was also blameless with him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore, the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his eyes. You see, only a fool could observe and survey the events of 1 and 2 Samuel and fail to see the distinction between Saul and David. And David's no fool. He saw that indeed God had rewarded Saul according to Saul's deeds. Don't forget that summary in 1 Chronicles 10. Saul died for his trespass, committed against the Lord, because of the word of the Lord which he did not keep. Because he asked the counsel of a medium, make inquire of it, did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore, Yahweh killed him and turned the kingdom over to David. God had rewarded Saul according to his deeds. Now, David, of course, had not been sinless in those years, but I think we can also say he had not been Saul, right? I mean, even at least in one case, remember that it took the intervention of Abigail, the wife of Nabal, to keep David from tripping into some kind of lethal revenge like Saul had been trying to do to him. Abigail had to intervene so that David didn't kill Nabal and all his people for some offensive slight against him. But the early David, whatever his faults were, and he certainly did have them, the early David, if we can call him that, is an entirely different man from Saul. Entirely different. He is different in character, he is different in faith, he is different in obedience. And clearly, God's removal of blessing from Saul and his placing of blessing on David was related in some way or another to David's right living. And David has to acknowledge that. He just can't pretend that he doesn't see what's going on. Verse 24, therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands. He's given Saul what he deserved, and to some level or another, he's given me what I've been living. With the kind, you show yourself kind. And can you see the face of Mephibosheth? Like a watermark behind those words? I mean, when you read verse 25, you got to see. There's a face behind that in the paper. It's called Mephibosheth. With the kind, Yahweh, you show yourself kind. With the blameless, you show yourself blameless. With the pure, you show yourself pure. With the crooked, Saul and those like him, you show yourself astute, clever enough to undo their crooked schemes. For you save an afflicted people. The crooked guys try to afflict people, take advantage of them. David says, God, you're smart enough to figure them out. You have saved an afflicted people, but haughty eyes you abase. Saul and many others in David's life had been crooked, but God had proven himself fully capable of entangling their webs and defeating their evil schemes. And so as David surveyed his life at the halfway point, he had to step back and acknowledge that there is, to some degree or another, there is a place for living right in God's plan for blessing. God does love to bless those who walk in his ways. It's just that simple. I mean, you can do the math and it just adds up. God has different plans. We know Job, right? But God does, as a pattern, love to bless those who walk in his ways. And David looks at his life and says, well, I think I'm living proof of that. That's a very important reflection. But by itself, if that was all there was to this psalm, it might sound a little bit like David's breaking his arm trying to pat himself on the back, right? Saul's a rotten guy, and aren't I wonderful? Aren't I the greatest glow-in-the-dark king in the universe, and what a special guy I am for it? I mean, you just say, you know, could there be pride here? You say, that is not David's heart at all. And therefore, after acknowledging, quite legitimately, it's a very biblical principle, the place of living right in God's plan for blessing his people, David quickly moves to the primacy of grace. in God's plan for blessing his people. The primary place of grace. Work out your salvation because it is God who is at work in you. Same idea. Don't expect God to bless you if you're living wrongly, if you're living wickedly, if you're living deceptively, living fraudulently. Don't expect God to bless you in that situation. However, how could we ever forget Moses' warning against self-righteousness in Deuteronomy 9? We studied it just a couple weeks ago. Do not say in your heart, Moses said to them, when the Lord your God has driven the Canaanites out before you, because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess the lands. Don't say that. Therefore, David quickly moved from acknowledging the place of living right in God's blessing to the primacy of grace in God's blessing. And in fact, his humble, joyful acknowledgement of God's gracious empowerment takes us all the way up to the psalm's conclusion. And in a sense, all we need to do is read the verses because now you understand the framework. Verse 28 and 9. For you, God, light my lamp. The Lord my God illumines my darkness. For by you I can run upon a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. You see, there had been a lot of dark nights in the first 37 years of David's life. But God had been the sunrise that ended all those dark nights. Moreover, God was the one who had given David the strength to serve in that absolutely vital, essential role as Israel's warrior king to deliver them from the Philistines and others. No sissy was going to defeat the Philistines. It just wasn't going to work. By God's empowering grace, David could charge upon a troop of enemies. He could be the first one over the wall when liberating one of those captured Israelite cities. Verse 30, as for God, his way is blameless. The word of the Lord is tried. He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. For who is God but the Lord? Who is a rock except our God? Is David the center of the picture here? No, it's God all the way. The God who girds me with strength and who makes my way blameless. Why had David been so different in faith and character and obedience from Saul? Was it because David was so good? No, it's because God was so gracious. The God who girds me with strength, the God who makes my way blameless. He makes my feet like hinds' feet, an antelope. He sets me upon my high places. He trains my hands for battle. In David's task, that was very important. So that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You didn't pray this week for arms that could bend a bow of bronze. You didn't. But that's only because your task was different than David's task. You also have given me the shield of your salvation. Your right hand upholds me and your gentleness makes me great. There's a fascinating verse. David is the legitimate God-appointed warrior king, whose job is to give Israel relief from unjust, tyrannical, violent, cruel military oppressors. He says, God, your right hand has upheld me. Your gentle nurturing. You're walking beside me. You're carrying me through all those dark and difficult years. Drawing me from the sheepfold to the throne. And it was a circuitous route, wasn't it? But God's gracious, gentle nurturing of David through all those years had been the key. The key to his success. Verse 36. You enlarged my steps under me, and my feet have not slipped. I pursued my enemies, and I overtook them. I did not turn back until they were consumed. I shattered them so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet, for you have girded me with strength for battle. What Saul never could do, David could. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. You have also made my enemies to turn their back on me. You destroyed those who hated me. You see, just as we value the police most when someone's trying to break into our home, and we value the army most when someone's trying to break into our country, so we need to understand these verses and David's valuing of God's military strengthening of him against the backdrop of the cruelty and the oppression of the Philistine years. David is God's man, given God's task, and it is a legitimate and necessary task. Verse 41. They cried for help, and there was none to save, even to the Lord, but he did not answer him. That doesn't sound like the Philistines, does it? But not all of David's enemies in those years wore Philistine armor, did they? Some of them are Israelites who superficially called upon Yahweh. Here again, we hear the echoes of the thunder of battle and the civil war that tormented Israel following Saul's death. Verse 42, then I beat them as fine as the dust before the wind. I emptied them out as mire on the streets. You have delivered me from the contentions of the people. You have placed me as the head of nations. A people whom I have not known serve me. As soon as they hear me, they obey me. Foreigners, that's Moab and Edom and Philistia and Ammon, all of them. Foreigners serve and submit to me. Foreigners fade away and come trembling out of their fortresses. See, north, south, east, west, David had been successful at every point of the compass, expanding the kingdom of Israel nearly to its God-appointed boundaries. But while God delighted to bless David because of David's noble man after God's own heart character, what David spends 18 verses here doing is gladly, joyfully, enthusiastically expounding the primacy of grace. So whatever God did in me to live righteously, the truth is it's all his work. It's all his grace. Live right, I think would be David's counsel to you, to me. Live right in God's. But understand that the source of your light, your strength, your purity, your swiftness, your skill, your protection, your stability, your peace, and your success, the source of it is God's grace. And of course, that Godward focus remained David's focus right all the way to the conclusion of the psalm, verse 46. The Lord lives. Who's the key? Yahweh. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Exalted be the God of my salvation. He has rescued the families of Israel, the men and the women of Israel who have been punished and oppressed, beaten and raped and robbed and killed by these enemies. David has finally delivered them, and he says, be exalted, the God of my salvation. The God who executes vengeance for me, subdues the peoples under me. He delivers me from my enemies. Surely you lift me above those who rise up against me. You, God, you rescue me from the violent man. Therefore, I will give thanks to you among the nations, O Lord, and I will sing praises to your name. He gives great deliverances to his king, shows his loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. And right there, we just put on a rocket pack and got thrust all the way ahead to Jesus Christ, didn't we? David and his descendants forever, helped by God. So, your task in life may not be David's task. You're probably pretty glad that it isn't, I would guess. But nonetheless, I think now you understand. Now you understand this psalm against this backdrop. And now hopefully you understand the place of living right in God's plan for blessing his people. There's a difference between David and Saul. And on the human level, there's a reason. David walks in God's ways and Saul doesn't. But having said that, you would also embrace the primacy of grace in that picture, in David's life and indeed in your own. Now, David, of course, would eventually fail to be the man he was supposed to be, the chapters we didn't look at in 2 Samuel. And God had to reward David according to his deeds, and it wasn't pretty, was it? And thankfully, there's a tale of two kings. In that tale of two kings, there's a third king. Saul, David. Saul's what happens when you get a bad king. David's what happens when you get a good king who messes up. Jesus Christ is what happens when you get a good king who never messes up. And because he will never fail, because David's eternal descendant will never fail, the tap of the Father's blessings will never be shut off. Never. See, even for Christ, David's forever descendant, even he will win his throne, rescue his people, and establish his kingdom by the will and the command and the empowerment of his Father. He will never fail, and there will never be a turning away. So, Psalm 18. God enthusiastically delivers, sometimes by dramatic rescue, other times by giving the strength to endure day by day. We saw that this morning. Tonight what we saw is as you live for His glory and to the glory of His Son, Jesus Christ, whatever your task, live right. Live right in order to walk in the sunshine of God's blessing. God loves to bless those who walk in His ways. But as you do it, never stray into self-righteousness. Always enthusiastically and joyfully acknowledge the primacy of God's grace on all of His deliverances, on all of His blessings. Lord, what an amazing psalm this is. And it would be easy to read through and just pick out a few phrases about You delivering and the Lord lives, blessed be My rock, exalted be the God of my salvation, and just take that typical kind of psalms terminology and run to the bank with it. And indeed, it is valuable in one sense in that way, but so much deeper. So much deeper when we understand who David was and what he had gone through and Your grace. And as we look at that picture, Lord, we want to walk in Your ways so that we might experience Your blessings. Sometimes You take those blessings away for a period of time because You have some other purpose, as You did with Job. But You do delight to bless Your people. We've experienced it. We know it. And when we walk in Your ways, things do go better. Our family is better. Our love for You is better. Our relationships are better. Lord, we want to walk in Your ways. At the end of it, we would never step back and say, and aren't I wonderful for having done it? No. We want to acknowledge the primacy of Your grace. You love to bless, but in the end, it's all Your grace. The ability to walk in righteousness is Your grace, as are the benefits that come from it. And so, Lord, thank You that You are our deliverer. Thank You that You are our strength. And we just celebrate tonight Your goodness to us and Your grace. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.